So those of us who are here on this great weekend of liberty, may we experience true liberty in Jesus. Well, God is good. If we only knew how good. You know, when you're in His presence, all your cares just slip away, don't they? Because His presence is filled with His goodness. And you know everything is going to be okay. Let's get started. Hebrews chapter 11. Do you want to walk with God? When you visualize that, what does it mean to you? Let's have a few brave souls share what you think that means.
Being like Him.
Those are two good answers, yeah.
Letting Him live through you.
Letting Him live through you. That's very general. It's very general.
Dying.
It's a good answer, but it's a very general answer. And that can mean many things to many people. And, you know, it's always going to mean the wonderful things.
Nothing.
Yeah. But what does that mean? What does it mean that He is Lord, He is Master, and we are nothing? What does that mean? What does it mean to walk with someone and your will be totally yielded to His will at all times? I love this, you know. I've been in the ministry over 30 years, and I always kind of chuckle when people tell me, oh, I'm doing this because God told me to do this, and I'm doing that because He spoke to me, and oh, Jesus told me this, and Jesus told me that, and it goes on and on and on. And you say, wow, the Lord talks to you a lot. How much time do you spend in prayer? Oh, well, I never have time for that. And I think, how can God talk to you if you don't pray? Number one, He could try, but you wouldn't understand it. Remember, He was born a Jew. He speaks Hebrew. So you're not going to know what His language sounds like if you don't spend time in prayer. You've all met people like that, right? And you wonder, especially when you see them going off doing crazy things that you know God's not in. To hear His voice, you have to know His ways. You can hear His voice occasionally without knowing His ways. But mostly, if you don't spend time in prayer and you don't spend time coming to know His ways, you think you're hearing from Him when you're really not. And have you ever noticed how when we say, God told me to do thus or told me to do so, it's always really wonderful things that they really want to do. So they just assign God's name to it. You've experienced that, haven't you? No. I know this is God's will. This is what I'm supposed to do. Yes, but this is terribly irresponsible what you're doing. I haven't known Him to be like that. No. The Word says that He will direct me by the desires of my heart, and boy, do I want to do this. Walking with the Son of God means walking in the low places. It means being stripped of your ego. If every directive He's giving you is building up your ego, there's something wrong, and you're hearing the wrong voice. Because His directives usually mean you're going to die on this one. You're going to die a little. Sometimes it means you're going to die a lot. His will deliberately leads you in to the place where there is a stream of bitterness, a little thread of bitterness. He will always guide you that way. Why? Because he's trying to help you develop dependency, selflessness. They kind of go together, you know. He's trying to break that ego, that pride. I've mentioned before that in one of the visitations that he gave me, he came to me and he shouldered me with himself. And I mean, pride went down just like that. It was non-existent. You don't understand or realize how much pride you have in your soul until the Lord takes it and there's nothing left. And you feel like you just fell, you know, from the Swiss Alps down to the valley. But the fall is so beautiful. It's so wonderful because it's so free. When pride is gone, self-protection is gone. Say, self-protection is gone. That's a biggie. That's very big, self-protection. Wherever we're protecting ourselves from people, circumstances, situations, we're also, we've got the walls up against God. So often we look at walking with Jesus like, you know, walking the high places of revelation and wonder. But remember, let me just, did I tell you to turn to Hebrews yet? Okay, well, just hold your hand there. Okay, someone tell me, where is the passage that talks about all the sufferings Paul went through? To this hour we have gone hungry and thirsty. We habitually wear but one undergarment. This is 1 Corinthians chapter 4. And shiver in the cold, we are roughly knocked about and wander around and homeless. And we still toil into weariness for our living, working hard with our own hands. Men revile us, wound us with the accursed sting. We bless them. When we are persecuted, we take it patiently and endure it. When we are slandered and defamed, we try to answer softly and bring comfort. We've been made and now are the rubbish, the filth of the world, and the offscouring of all things. There's yet another passage where he talks about some of the other injustices that he endured. I don't know why it's skipping my mind. I want to share this with you. Lord, bring it back to me. I want to talk to you about this for a minute. I feel like I'm supposed to. By speaking 2 Corinthians 7, or 6, verse 7, by speaking the word of truth and the power of God with weapons of righteousness for the right hand to attack and for the left hand to defend, amid honor and dishonor, in defaming and evil report, in praise and good report, we are branded as deceivers, imposters, yet vindicated as truthful and honest. We are treated as unknown and ignored by the world, and yet we are well known and recognized by God and his people. As dying, and yet here we are alive, as chastened by suffering, and yet not killed, as grieved and mourning, yet we are always rejoicing, as poor ourselves, yet bestowing riches on many, as having nothing, and yet in reality possessing all things. And there's another passage that tells some more. Where is it, Danny? Five times I have received 2 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 24. Five times I have received from the hands of the Jews 40 lashes, all but one. Three times I have been beaten with rods. Once I have stoned. Three times I have been aboard a ship, wrecked at sea, a whole night and a day, and I have spent adrift on the deep. Many times on journeys, exposed to perils from rivers, perils from bandits, perils from my own nation, perils from the Gentiles, perils from the city. Boy, that word's getting to be very common. Perils in the desert places, perils from the Gentiles, perils from those opposing as believers, but destitute of Christian knowledge and piety, in toil and hardship, watching often, through sleepless nights, in hunger and thirst, frequently driven to fasting by want, in cold and exposure and lack of clothing. And besides those things that are without, there is the daily inescapable pressure of my cares and anxieties for all the churches. Who is weak that I do not feel his weakness? Who is made to stumble and fall and have his faith hurt that I am not on fire with sorrow or indignation? If I must boast, I will boast of the things that show my infirmity, of the things by which I am made weak and contemptible in the eyes of the opponents. And I love this. The God and Father of the Lord Jesus Christ knows. He who is blessed and to be praised forever. More than that, I do not lie. What does it mean to walk with Jesus? It means to enter in on a path where the soul is at last reduced to become subservient to the Spirit. What constantly feeds the strength of the soul? But our flesh. That's why we must die daily. And since we will not do it on our own, he must lead us in the paths of righteousness. What does it mean to be led in the paths of righteousness? Your flesh is not righteous. Your soul is not righteous. Can we agree with that? To be led on the paths of righteousness means that there must be a conversion. A transformation must take place. He must convert the converted. He must awaken the sleeping church. He must awaken the spirit that is bound by the demands of the soul and the flesh, and create a strength, a desire, a demand, a command within to rise above the demands of the soul. So this is what it means to be led on the paths of righteousness. It's not going to be easy. We're always going to think it's going to be much easier than it is. We'll always think that way. Because our flesh will never lead us to the cross. Amen, you're getting awfully quiet. Our flesh will never lead us to the cross. Neither will our soul. We can want Jesus so badly, but if it's up to our soul and up to our flesh, we see him hanging on the cross, and we're headed in the opposite direction as far as we can go, as fast as we can go, longing for Jesus every step of the way. You know that, right? To walk with him, it takes his spirit, the strength of his spirit, and it takes great faith. We start out on the walk with small faith, but our faith grows as we learn his ways and we learn to trust him in the difficult times. How many of you agree? Paul did not have an easy life. Now, I know that there is, you know, one prophet that says that his hardships were because he was so rebellious. But I'm telling you, I have heard from the mouth of the Lord himself, that is not the case. I'm not saying that Paul did not at times go about his own way. He was quite human, and he did learn how to die daily. But most of his hardships came because God was doing a deep work in him in response to Paul's hunger. We admire him for his great intellect. We admire him for all the sufferings he endured, don't we? And yet he loved Jesus so much. He loved the church so much. He just kept going no matter what. But there was something else calling. And that was the quest to know Christ. Yes, he cared about the churches. He cared about the lost. He cared about his own people. But this one thing I know, this one thing I do, he wanted to walk with Jesus. Now, the path is not easy. I don't care how much you try to cooperate. The Lord takes you by a way that you know not. He leads the blind by a way they know not. Why aren't you taking notes? Okay, only a few are taking notes. You're bewildered. You're in a state of bewildered wonder. So you forgot, right? It's not easy to walk with the Lord. It's difficult. And it must be difficult. Because if it was not difficult, we wouldn't need him in the walk. The walk is designed to create in us a deeper surging of passion and desire for this dependency, this mature dependency upon Christ. Are you with me? So we cry out, help me die. I want to die, Lord. Help me die. And he gets the scalpel out, you know, the physician's scalpel. And before he can apply it, we're gone. It's true, isn't it? We can smile. He knows us so well. He knows the way we are. Gotta protect. It takes faith to walk with God. Faith in his goodness. Faith in his mercy. Faith in his wisdom. I can remember one time the Lord took me into a spiritual experience. This was, gosh, probably 29 years ago. He picked me up and we went flying. And he would take me down into circumstances where he was cutting open the heart of the person in front of us. He had a surgeon's scalpel in his hand, and he would cut open the heart with precision. And when the heart would be cut open, all kinds of blackness would start coming out. It was gory, it was ugly, it was stinky. And all the people around the person whose heart had just been cut open started complaining, moaning, griping, harsh criticisms against Jesus, the great physician. The person whose heart was just cut open would join the voices. And the Lord would stand there so patiently. You could see at times pain would enter into his eyes because some of the criticisms would reflect a lack of trust, and that would hurt him. And I'd say, why are you just leaving the wound open like that, Lord? And he would tell me, this is necessary. The poison cannot be released any other way. The corruption cannot be poured out any other way. So I must do it this way. And we'd stand there for a long time, and he would tolerate that, go through all of that. And then he would turn to me and he'd say, it's time to go. And I'd think, but you haven't sewn up the heart yet. I mean, you know, that was the thought that would go through my mind. And he could read my thoughts. Have any of you felt like your heart's been cut open? I see one, two, three, four, five. He could read my thoughts. And he'd say, I must leave it like this for a time. But I know everything is going to be all right. That's why we stayed and we waited. I know everything will be fine. So we're going to go and we'll come back when it's time for me to close up the heart. And then we'd go to the next person, a totally new situation. None of these people did I know. We'd go into the room and he would do the same thing again. And again, the same thing happened. All night long, we were on this journey. At the end of the journey, I said, Lord, I feel tired. None of these people trusted you. None of these people understood that what you were doing to answer their prayers and out of your great love for them. But you were so patient and so kind, so merciful, so compassionate. And you took all of their murmuring, all of their criticisms, all of their complaining. You just stood and in love bore it. And he said, this is the work of the great physician. I have yet to meet anyone who understands. But when the trial is over and it's time for me to sew the heart back up, they will understand. And he was gone. But he had taught me something about his ways. How does he put us on this path? How else is he going to reveal to us the stuff he needs to remove? How else is he going to help us understand what he sees deep inside of us that is part of the everything that can be shaken category? Except that we too see it. Once we see it, then we can grow to hate it enough to let him remove it. So this is how he works with our will. He takes us into these difficult situations out of his great love. Say, out of his great love. Difficulties arise out of his great love. Say it again. And he's showing me my stuff. Come on, say it. So that I'll get on my knees until he removes it. David Wilkerson told of a time he became ill and was hospitalized. And he said to the Lord, you've got to get me well. You've got to heal my body and get me out of this hospital. Lord, I love you so much. I just want to win the world to you. And he said, I brought you to this place to tell you. I just want to win you. I'd be happy if I could just win you. We have these grandiose ideas, don't we? But when it's all said and done, the thing that is the most important to Jesus is that he owns this heart. Of course, that also means obedience. That also means obedience. And so that's frequently means you're going to go to the dry places, you're going to go to the low places, you're going to go to the places where no man would fear to tread. But he'll never give you more than you can handle, plus grace. Praise the Lord. Okay, are we at Hebrews 11? Aroused by faith, Moses, when he had grown to maturity and become great, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, because he preferred to share the oppression, suffer the hardships, bear the shame of the people of God, rather than to have the fleeting enjoyment of a sinful life. He considered the contempt and abuse and shame borne for the Christ, the Messiah, who was to come to be greater wealth than all the treasures of Egypt. For he looked forward and away to the reward. Motivated by faith, he left Egypt behind him, being unawed and undismayed by the wrath of the king. For he never flinched but held staunchly to his purpose and endured steadfastly as one who gazed on him who is invisible. So the first lesson of how do you walk with Jesus is you must leave Egypt behind. What does it mean to leave Egypt behind? Egypt is the spirit of the world. It's the spirit of the world. How does the spirit of the world affect our lives? Everything you desire outside of God, everything you desire outside of God is probably provoked by the spirit of the world. Now, if you want to get married and God's in that marriage, then, you know, he's in it. But if you want to get married and you're willing to marry just whoever you want to marry, and God is not saying this is my best, well, then the spirit of the world is provoking it. If you want to have three children and God is saying, I want you to have four, and you're saying, I don't want four, I want only three, the spirit of the world is helping in that decision. If you want to buy a house or buy a car, and God is not saying, I need you to go buy this house because I'm going to use it for my glory, then it's probably your flesh and the spirit of the world. Or I need you to go buy this car because you're going to need it. It's probably the spirit of the world that is provoking it. So these are some of the decision-making processes that you might go through to discern, is God leading or is your own soul leading in these decisions? And sometimes it takes a while to get an answer when you start to pray. Also, let's look at, where's the best place? Okay, let's look at Romans 1, chapter 9, verse 19, or verse 18. For God's holy wrath and indignation are revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who in their wickedness repress and hinder the truth and make it inoperative. For that which is known about God is evident to them and made plain in their inner consciousness, because God himself has shown it to them. For ever since the creation of the world, his invisible nature and attributes, that is, his eternal power and divinity, have been made intelligible and clearly discernible in and through the things that have been made. So men are without excuse, altogether without any defense or justification. Because when they knew and recognized him as God, they did not honor and glorify him as God or give him thanks. That is provoked by the spirit of the world. This self-sovereignty, this lack of appreciation for God's divinity, his sovereignty, his lordship. But instead they became futile and godless in their thinking. Verse 21. With vain imaginings, foolish reasonings, stupid speculations, and their senseless minds were darkened. Again, this is the operation of the spirit of the world. This is what happens when you cease to give God the glory and honor due his name. When you cease to hold him up in your heart as he is due, you start on a path where you are embracing greater and greater darkness, claiming to be wise. Ooh. Spirit of the world. They became fools. Professing to be smart, they made simpletons of themselves. And by them, the glory and the majesty and the excellence of the immortal God was exchanged for and represented by images resembling mortal man and birds and beasts and reptiles. Therefore, God gave them up to their own lust. Oops. Spirit of the world, calling you, driving you, enticing you, always to satisfy your own lusts. Just because you want it doesn't mean you need it. And just because you think you need it doesn't mean God thinks you need it. Therefore, God gave them up in the lust of their own hearts and to sexual impurity, to the dishonoring of their bodies among themselves, abandoning themselves to degrading powers of sin, because they exchanged the truth of God for a lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. For this reason, God gave them over and abandoned them to vile affections and degrading passions. For the women exchanged their natural function for an unnatural and abnormal one. And the men who turned from natural relations with women and were set ablaze, burning out and consumed with lust for one another, men committing shameful acts with men and suffering in their own bodies and personalities the inevitable consequences and penalty of their own wrongdoing, and going astray, which was their fitting retribution. And so since they did not see fit to acknowledge God or approve of him, to consider him worth the knowing, what does the Bible say? It says, lean not to your own understanding. Lean not unto your own understanding, but in all, say all of your ways, acknowledge him. And he will direct your path. That doesn't mean, and this is what most Christians think it means, because they want desperately for it to mean this. It doesn't mean you're skipping down the primrose path. I love you, Jesus. I acknowledge you, Jesus. I know you're here to get me through this wonderful primrose path. And everything is going to be great on the other side. That's not acknowledging him. Acknowledging him means don't get on the path until you've heard the voice of the Lord, until he has clarified in your heart and by circumstances that this is what he wants of you. And when he's leading, sometimes you'll feel that he's close and sometimes you won't. So if you don't have the knowledge of that this is where he wants you, you're not going to have the faith to make it through to the end, and at some point you will stop and turn around. Does that sound possible? Because the hardships may just get rough enough that you're going to think he's not in it. And if you have, you know, the way a lot of Christians believe, you're going to believe that this second thought is the higher thought. Things are rough, so God's not in it. So I'm leaving. Adios, goodbye. And then you don't fulfill the will of God. What would Paul have done if he had made that decision? What would we have done? Look at all that Paul learned about Christ through his suffering. You think he didn't ask why? You think he didn't ask how? You think he didn't ever say to God, I don't understand. I'm trying to serve you. This isn't the way we've been taught in Judaism. This isn't the way we've been taught that you act. I mean, God, I don't understand. When Nehemiah went back to Jerusalem, he had everything he needed to fulfill the task. This is the way we Jews are taught. When Moses went out to do everything that you asked him to do, he had everything he needed, and you were right there. This is the way we Jews are taught. This seems to be the exact opposite of everything I've ever been taught. How can you be in this? Do you think he might have thought that way? I can promise you did. Why do you think we have the beautiful teaching on love? Because Paul cried. He wept. What is love? How does it work? How do I understand love that perseveres in the midst of so much hardship? He wept because he was hurting. He was a Pharisee and the son of Pharisees. I can promise you that the self-righteousness went very deep in Paul, as deep as it can go in a man. And that's why God had to take him through so much affliction, is to deal with this inner nature that Paul wanted to see dead so that Christ could live in him. It was not easy. How many of you have tried to die lately and you think it's great fun? But remember, you prefer to bear the hardships rather than to be identified with Pharaoh. You made the choice to identify yourself with the people of God rather than to live as a son of Pharaoh. That was your choice. No one made you do it. And even so, though you may not understand it, there is a hunger in you to leave Egypt behind. You really do want to learn the ways of love. You really do want to learn the ways of peace. You really do want to learn the ways of righteousness. You really do want to separate yourself from everything that can hinder the knowledge of God. There's something in you that's calling you on. You may not like the game. You may not like the warfare. You may not like all the difficulties. You may get upset every day over everything you're going through, but something in you is crying for truth. And you have come to realize you will never, say never, you will never find truth as a son of Pharaoh. So don't get out there in the middle of the journey and start vacillating. Keep your eyes fixed like Moses did. Keep your eyes fixed on the one that is invisible. Yet, the one you know is calling you, loves you, will bring you through the hardships. You know, part of the journey is learning to understand how God sees other people and how He sees circumstances and how He sees your own heart. As part of the journey, you have to go through it. The problem comes when you want God, but you're not willing to look at the junk in you. My dear friends, I cannot tell you over the years how many people have said to me, I want you to mentor me. I want you to teach me the way of God. I promise you, I will learn, I will learn, I will do whatever you say. I want to learn the way of God. And can I tell you what? I have never found one person, not in all these years, that is really willing to learn the way of God. Not even one. Why? Because to learn the way of God, you have got to abandon your way. And that is very, very hard. It is very difficult. To learn God's way, you've got to love to pray. You've got to learn to love discipline. Now, I can't say that I'm crazy about discipline, but I have to be very honest with you. I would be terrified if God ever spoke to me and said, I'm not going to discipline you anymore. I would fall to my face, grab a hold of His robe, and say, well, then you can't go anywhere, because I'm not letting you go until you change your mind. The disciplines of God are not easy, but they're adaptable, and they adapt to your present need, your present level of grace. He's not going to discipline you like He will discipline me. He will not discipline you over the same things that He will discipline me over. Some people would say, why would he discipline you over that? That's stupid. Well, for you it is. But for where I walk, it's not. He doesn't think it's stupid. It's all adapted to our present need, our present level of grace, what we know and understand about God, what we're able to walk in the knowledge of God. He never overdoes it because He knows that we're frail. And we can't bear it if He's too heavy with us. And He'll take us through a lesson. You know, I'm sure you've heard about this before. But He'll take you through the lesson, and He'll carry you around the mountain, and around the mountain, and around the mountain, and around the mountain, until you get so sick of seeing the east side of the mountain, you just don't want to go around this mountain anymore. But He'll take you around it as many times as He needs to teach you the lesson, if you're serious. If He pulls you away from the lesson prematurely, it's because He knows you're not serious. Some people can learn to walk with God over 40 years. Moses, it was 80 years. Abraham, again, many, many, many years. Some, He'll give them 3 years, 5 years, 7 years, 10 years. Why the difference? Because He knows the one that he's giving a smaller space of time to is not really serious. So he'll take you around the mountain once or twice, and when he sees that your heart is not serious, he just lets go. And when he lets go, the desire for union leaves. You no longer desire it. Moses, where did he run? Into a neighboring town? Into a neighboring village? No, he ran out to the desert, away from every creature comfort. He ran out to places unknown. He ran out to the backside of the desert. When he ran, he didn't know it was going to be a 40-year stint. I think he was probably thinking it would be more like 1 or 2 years, 3 years, 5 years. But never did he dream it would be 40 years in the backside of the desert, away from all of the comforts of Egypt. As I told you before, his season out there was very difficult for him. He learned how to become a man of prayer. And that's what God needs you to do. Become people of prayer. If you do not become people of prayer, then that shows him you really aren't really serious about having union. In becoming people of prayer, also people of the Word. Learn to love the Word. Learn to hug the Word. Learn to depend on the Word like you would food. Because it's prayer that opens up the Word. It's prayer that opens up your heart. It's prayer that opens up your heart. It's prayer that spills the two into the same pool. Truth from the Word and the love of your heart. He joins it in prayer. He prepares your heart for the placement of these great diamonds, these great jewels, these great and precious truths through prayer. If you don't have a prayer life, you will learn to judge everything in the Word by your mind. Some people are very intelligent, some people are not as intelligent, but you can imagine the many, many meanings, the many interpretations of the Word that are given to the body of Christ through people who are not people of prayer, because they have interpreted the truth through their mind, their intellect. They have figured it out through their soul realm. So they don't really know what the truth is. And then they start feeding that junk to the church, and the church gets all fattened up on the truth that is no truth at all. So it is very important to have a prayer life. How did Moses gaze steadfastly, hold staunchly to his purpose, and endured? He endured. Endured what? Joy? Endured great times? Is that what he endured? You don't endure great times, right? Well, maybe some people do. This is too much fun. I'm enduring. He endured. Implication, hardship. How did he do it? How did he maintain his gaze steadfastly on the one that is invisible? Through prayer. It's the only way. Through prayer. It is the only way. What a beautiful call. What a beautiful path to become a person of prayer. To enter into the throne room of God and come to know him. As Paul said, and the wonders of his person. Begin to know how he thinks. Begin to know how he feels. Begin to know what he's doing in the earth. Begin to know what he's doing in you. To know what he looks like, to know what he feels like, to know. How do you do it? Two people meet. He kind of likes her. She kind of likes him. And you know, as people will do in the flesh, they begin to flirt. She's flirting with him. He's flirting with her. She knows the words to say. He knows the words to say. And they like each other a little more. And the relationship continues to grow. He becomes the prince on the white horse in his shining armor. Because you know, a man can say everything right when he's courting. You know, they go through this ritual. May we call it that? They go through this ritual. And then he pops the question, because now he knows she's going to say yes. They go through this ritual. He pops the question. She says yes. And then they get married. And now, intimacy. But between meeting and the flirting and the courtship, what's happening to her vision? It's becoming more and more focused on who? On him. If he doesn't call, she gets nervous. If he calls and he's moody, she gets depressed. I mean, this does happen, right? If something is not going right for him, then she just has to take control. If something's not going right with her, he has to take control. Men are fixers. You know, things are changing. Her focus is becoming more geared toward him and his toward her. Am I right? And it's the same with the Lord. They get married and it's even more focused. Because now there's intimacy. After 20 years, if they have made it that long, she can almost read his thoughts. She even acts like him, and he acts a little like her. Because they become more and more one. Am I right? Intimacy does that, doesn't it? It also helps you through very difficult times. You look at some marriages and you wonder, how in the world did they make it? Well, because God puts something in the heart when he says, and the two become one. And it's the same with Jesus. He's calling us out of the outer court, or out of Egypt, out of the outer court, and he's calling us in to the inner sanctums of a knowledge of God. You can learn some things about Jesus in the holy place, but the things your heart is craving, you can only learn in the Holy of Holies. And that means you have to leave Egypt behind, the spirit of the world behind, the things of the world behind, the desires, the lusts, the passions, the attitudes. All those things that the Bible condemns, it has to be left behind. There's no other alternative. You cannot look at the Lord 10 years from now and say, well, I didn't know about that, Lord. Because the Bible has it before your face. This is acceptable, this is not acceptable. And every day you're making a decision. Do I want him bad enough to let go of the things I need to let go? Do I? Even if it means suffering to get rid of it, do I? Do I really? You'll never know if you don't have a prayer life. That's the only way it can happen. Intimacy. Intimacy. Intimacy with Jesus. Intimacy. Say intimacy. I know for men that's a great word. They love that word. That's hard, isn't it? Intimacy. But only in intimacy can you learn his heart and find your heart and the strength to let your heart go. Now, what happens in a walk like this? What happens? What happens when intimacy begins to occur? What happens? Jesus becomes very jealous. He becomes very possessive. He becomes very passionate for you. And he, in his jealousy, will do many things to separate you unto himself. When he starts investing himself in you in that way, he doesn't want you going out and dumping yourself into the world and polluting and contaminating the work that he has invested in you. So he'll pull you closer and try to develop in your heart a hatred for these things. And if you don't learn it easily, he'll help you learn it the hard way, because he is invested in you. It takes commitment. But you cannot stay on the fence. Well, I want a little bit of the world this way, a little bit of my will this way, and I want a little bit of God. Well, actually, I want a lot of God, but I really don't want to let go of some of my will. He'll pull you closer and try to teach you to hate the stuff you once loved. And at the same time, he'll show you sides of himself. He'll show you his face. He'll show you his heart. He'll let you feel and experience that tender heart, that noble heart. He'll let you weep with him over the things that hurt his noble heart. He'll let you begin to see sin the way he sees it. That's devastating. He'll let you begin to see the world the way he sees it. That's devastating. He'll let you start carrying burdens that were way too heavy for you before. But today, it has become more normal, more natural, because you have seen him, you have known him, and you have walked in the grace, the enlargement that you must go through to carry the heavier burdens. Remember that, I mean, he's not going to give the burden to a child that he will give to his wife. He will not whisper into the ear of a child what he will whisper into the ear of his bride. He will not blow on your sacred heart, if you're a child, what he will blow if you're his wife. The relationship grows, it deepens, it develops, until you can't bear to be apart from him. You can't bear the separation of knowing you've had a bad attitude and he had to step back because that's intolerable to him. You can't bear the separation. You know that his heart is tender, it's noble, it's precious, it's sacred, and you want to protect it even from your sin. These are the things I'm giving you in a nutshell from 1 to 40 years. And each night that the Lord will allow me to do it, I'll give you more specifics to help you understand how to get to these various places you need to go in grace. I want you to know walking with Jesus is not easy, but it is the most wonderful thing you can ever have in life. There is nothing like it. It's not easy, but I wouldn't trade it for anything. Not even when he has to discipline me. I just want to walk with him closer and closer. And when he sees that in you, he'll give it to you. Amen. How many of you want to walk with Jesus? Oh boy, you guys are great. Father, that must be why you brought them here, because they want the true liberty.